This is Roy Bailey and you're listening to Sheffield Live on 93.2 FM.
We're open for business live.
Good morning. It's just after 9 o'clock. It's Friday. It's the 23rd of November 2018. I'm Jamie Veitch, your host for the next hour for Sheffield Live's business and social enterprise programme, Business Live. We're broadcasting live from our radio studio in the centre of Sheffield. We're going out on FM radio and through our internet live stream. However you're listening, the show's also available as a podcast later on from the Sheffield Live website. So podcasts. Who was on last week's show? And if you missed it, you can catch the podcast. Well, Andre Kerpiel, who runs Be Blessed, a newly launched Sheffield-based social enterprise working with honeybees to help lift people out of poverty, was on the programme last week. And Andre talked about the work that they've already done to empower entrepreneurship internationally in Africa and to support people at risk of isolation and depression in Sheffield. It was really fascinating talking with Andre. I really enjoyed that. I also really enjoyed speaking with last week's other guest, Steve Manley, who is the joint MD of Universal Office Products and, at 43, the youngest ever Sheffield Chamber President. He's a former teenage entrepreneur too. So if you missed last week's programme featuring Steve and Andre, panic not. Go to sheffieldlive.org, find radio shows, look up Business Live, and the podcast is there. But that was then, this is now, and who is on today? Well, in a few minutes, I'm delighted to welcome our guest of today onto the microphone, as it were, Alan Holland of Dark Peak Gear. He was in briefly a couple of weeks ago, and you might recall that Alan is behind the Nesh jacket, the warmest jacket in the world, as described. It launched on Kickstarter shortly after Alan's appearance on Sheffield Live with a target of £15,000. Now, the Kickstarter campaign still has 18 days to go, and many folk who are running crowdfunding campaigns might be pretty nervous at this stage. Will they or won't they make it? But not Alan, because Dark Peak's Kickstarter is, as we speak, hitting £52,000 worth of pledges. That's remarkable. We're going to hear all about how they've got to where they have got to and what the Nesh jacket actually is in a few minutes when we speak with Alan. And I'm really looking forward to a more in-depth chat with him than we had time for last time. So catch that coming up in a couple of minutes. But meantime, what's going on in business? What's going on in social enterprise? Well, 69 entrepreneurs, including Emma Jones, the founder of Enterprise Nation and a recent guest on this programme, and Jimmy Cregan, founder of Jimmy's Iced Coffee, who you might recall has been an interviewee on this show. They're two of the 69 entrepreneurs who've signed a letter, an open letter to the government, urging acceptance of Theresa May's European Union withdrawal deal and warning that livelihoods are at risk from a no-deal Brexit. The deal isn't perfect, according to the letter, but the signatories have not heard any viable alternative, and the letter was coordinated by Emma. And it says, goes on to state that a no deal would be an absolute disaster for small companies and for people they employ. It also warns that the entrepreneurs have not had the luxury of spending millions on Brexit advice, scenario planning, or establishing a new base in mainland Europe away from the UK and the UK workforce. It's urged the government to accept the deal. What do you think? You can get in touch with the show. Send me an email, drop me a text, find me on Twitter, and I'll give out the contact details in a moment. Coming up in a week's time is Small Business Saturday, a week and a day, a week tomorrow. And that's a UK-wide grassroots non-commercial campaign to highlight small business success and to encourage consumers to shop local. Small Business Saturday reaches millions of customers and millions of businesses every year. And you can get involved now at smallbusinesssaturdayuk.com. So take a look at the website and find out the ways that you can promote your business, your organisation, and get listed, showcase what you're doing, and much, much more. And the government has set aside £600,000 to support marginalised women and disadvantaged people returning to work, it announced earlier this week. The money has been announced by Penny Mordaunt, who's the Minister for Work and Equalities, and it includes £500,000 to support people returning to work, focusing on individuals facing additional barriers, including people with disabilities, the homeless and victims of domestic abuse. A further £100,000 will be used for bespoke support for very marginalised women, some of whom have little or no work history. And that's £600,000. Now, Penny Mordaunt said that around 1.8 million women were currently economically inactive because they were caring for their family, more than eight times the number of men in that position as well. And she also said that women are disproportionately more likely to work in roles that tended to be less well paid. So whilst many folk have welcomed the announcement of the money, plenty have said it's £600,000 isn't going to go very far. Now, on the topic of women in the workplace and female entrepreneurs, Debbie Wasko is the co-founder of Albright, which is a support organisation for female entrepreneurs. She says that 1 in 10 women in the UK who want to start their own company don't. She said that if they did, an even greater economic impact could be unlocked if more were encouraged to start up, and that the economy would benefit from a £10 billion boost by 2020 if those people were provided with the required support and advice. Wasko says there's still a huge gender imbalance in the world of investment, with only 2% of all capital raised in the UK going to women-led firms. And she says that we need to encourage more women into senior funding roles and encourage men and women alike to invest in female founders, she says. So, as ever, I would welcome your views on what's going on in business, in social enterprise. You can get in touch. Find me on Twitter, Jamie Veitch. Find Sheffield Live on Twitter. Send a text, 07904 272 200. Send an email, jamie@sheffieldlive.org. Because whether you're running a business or a social enterprise, whether you're an employer, an employee, we're always really keen to hear from you. Put yourself forward, comment on what's going on. Simply get in touch. It'd be great to hear from you. So I think it's time to turn to our guest for the day, Alan Holland of Dark Peak Gear, and Nesh Jacket, the warmest jacket in the world, overfunding on Kickstarter, smashed through its £15,000 target, up to £52,000 already, with 18 days still to go. Alan, good morning.
Good morning, Jamie.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So, I mean, it was the appearance on Sheffield Live that what done it,
absolutely.
I suppose.
Yes.
No, it's absolutely amazing. Really, really impressive performance there. Congratulations.
Thanks.
And
yeah,
it shows people obviously love the idea behind the jacket.
I think so, yeah. Yeah, it's obviously something we're doing is resonating. It's either the specs and quality of the jacket that's shining through, or the message that we're trying to put out, the socially responsible message.
Yes. Well, I'd like you to talk about both, if you could, please.
Sure.
You gave us a sort of quick taste when you were on the show 3 or 4 weeks ago. But remind us, the Nesh jacket then, the warmest jacket in the world. Let's talk about specs. Let's talk about who it's designed for, first of all, and then let's also talk about the socially responsible element as well. But
sure.
But what's the jacket all about?
So, yeah, we have actually ourselves been in manufacturing for many years, and we're keen outdoors people, and we really wanted to get into the outdoor apparel market, and we thought that it's one of the core items that you actually need is an insulated jacket if you're going out for a walk in the peaks, that sort of thing. And so we kind of set about about designing a high spec down jacket, which actually then evolved into a couple of different insulation options. And so in broad terms, the Nesh jacket is a high performance ultralight jacket. It's got elite specs, but it doesn't have the high retail price tag that you would expect if you bought from a high street retailer.
Yeah. Okay, great. So really elite specs, and it's designed for people who enjoy the outdoors. And in the UK, that can come with dampness as well, and it can be very cold. And people in the who enjoy going out to the Peak District will know that that feeling of sort of claggy damp in winter sometimes. But it's so wonderful to be outside.
Yes, yeah. So yeah, we kind of looked at all the different jackets that were on the market and basically took the best specs from each of them to give you a kind of a broad overview. It's got an ultralight nylon shell. It has two insulation options, as I mentioned. We use 850 fill power responsibly sourced goose down. That means that the down itself is coming from the food industry, and that the geese are of higher welfare, how they're treated through their lives. And then we also looked at it introducing a synthetic insulation as well for people who are either allergic to down or choose not to wear animal products. We put all the features that we thought were really necessary on a jacket. So it's we've got a hoodless version, but it also it comes with an insulated hood that's helmet compatible. If you're a rock climber like I am, it means that you can put the hood over the top of the helmet if you're out of the crag one day, out of the Stanage Edge, that sort of thing. Yeah. It's very lightweight. It weighs in at about 340 grams, 12 ounces, and it packs down into its own pocket, really small, so you can just throw it into your pack. It doesn't take up too much space, too much weight. It's got all the pockets that you need, so it's got insulated hand warmer pockets, which have got zips on them. It's got two inner pockets, which are wide and deep, and that allow you to perfectly fit an ordnance survey map for anyone who actually still uses those. But yeah, orienteering is still quite a popular thing here,
certainly,
and that was important to us. But those pockets also serve a dual purpose of being able to put a pair of gloves in flat, so you don't have to stuff your gloves into your waist pockets. It's got a zipper chest pocket so that you can put your phone in there, which is obviously essential these days. The jacket has got elasticated cords at the waist and at the hood so that you can tighten them up, keep drafts out. And we also included a feature that we really like that's common on ski jackets, but no one puts them on down jackets, which are basically wrist gaiters or wrist mitts. So they're a kind of half glove that comes out of the cuff that helps to keep your hand warm. And we thought it's a really nice feature, and we don't know why no one actually ever integrated them into down jackets. So we popped those in too. So that's kind of a bit of an overview of the specs. And what we really say is that it basically compares to the best jackets that the leading brands put out there. Think of any of those big high street brands. They're going to charge £250, £300 for a jacket. And the reason that they do that is because of their business model is set up. There's needs to be margin made in there for the all the different components of that. So the brand themselves, the manufacturer, they need to make their margin. They've also got huge marketing budgets, which means that they've got to charge a bit more to start with. But they don't sell direct to the retailer. They always go through middlemen distributors. So the distributor buys the jacket, they get their cut. The distributor sells it on to the retailer, and then the retailer double it. They double the price that they bought the jacket for, and then they sell it to you.
Yes.
And so when you buy a jacket in you know, big high street, big box store, I won't name names, you're paying all of these different people's profit margins, not necessarily for the quality of the product.
Indeed. Yes.
So we cut them all out. We basically decided that we would operate on a direct-to-consumer model.
Yes.
So that means that initially we were launching through the Kickstarter platform. So you're basically buying straight from us. And then after Kickstarter, that will merge into website sales.
Right,
strictly just website. So it won't be available in store.
No, you're going to continue with the direct-to-consumer model.
Yep.
And that's been really, really successful for, say, I know in bicycles, both mountain bikes and road bikes, there are a couple of businesses that have pioneered in that industry a direct to consumer model, and they've said exactly the same thing. They've said that there are multiple stages between manufacturer and consumer, each requiring a profit margin. So they've said, well, we'll do this. You've obviously seen that that's an issue as well, and you're able to provide something of equivalent equivalent quality or better quality than people will find in the shops,
yes,
at significantly less money. And obviously people are seeing that and have embraced that, given the results we've already seen on your Kickstarter campaign before it's closed. People obviously like the sound of the jacket.
Yes, yeah, I think so. I think that's definitely part of it. And it's possibly that, but it's possibly the other part of our message that might be resonating as
yes.
well, or a combination of the two. And we looked at all of that margin that was being taken by the distributors, by the retailers, mm-hmm. and by the brands themselves with these huge marketing budgets, and thought, well, what could we do with that? Well, first thought was we could just go on holiday mm-hmm. and, you know, lavish it around in the sun, charge loads of money and make huge profit margins. But realistically, that wasn't what we're like. So we decided, actually, or what can you do with that? First off, we thought the most sensible thing to do is to just give people a fantastic jacket for a reasonable price.
Yeah.
And so the cost of our jackets versus those brands is actually significantly lower. You're talking 30 or 40% lower than some of those big retail brands for a comparable quality product. But there's also something else that really that hit out at us, and it's that businesses these days have a big responsibility to be socially responsible and to actually give back to the world and to their community than just turning a profit. And so one thing that really struck with us was the homelessness situation, both at home and abroad. And we thought, as a manufacturer, we were in a unique position to be able to help. We found statistics that said that every single year, the most in-demand item of clothing at homeless shelters is winter jackets.
Mm-hmm.
And these shelters, they basically receive donations of hopefully lightly used jackets from people who are, you know, socially conscious, but often they receive stuff that's been well used and actually isn't very fit for purpose. And it's also, you know, someone has bought this, their jacket that they donated for, you know, the purposes of going to the pub, for example. It's not necessarily fit for purpose of somebody who doesn't have permanent shelter.
No.
And as a manufacturer, as designers, we're in a unique position to be able to service that need. And we thought, well, instead of making these large profits, what if we took some of that profit and we bought another jacket, and then we give a jacket for every jacket sold to the homeless?
Yes.
And so that's basically what we're doing. The idea is that we're working with charities, and we will buy jackets in bulk and donate them to homeless shelters. And it's also worth pointing out that the jacket we give isn't the same as the one that we sell. For many reasons, a high-tech down jacket isn't actually fit for needs of someone without permanent shelter. Down, for example, as an insulator, when it gets wet, it loses its insulation properties.
Yeah.
It requires a kind of a level of care that, you know, you've got to wash it once a year, and you have to take care of the outer, that sort of thing. So we're the first to admit that just donating another one of these jackets wouldn't really have been kind of smiled upon us. So
no.
We instead actually, as designers, set about working with these charities to develop a jacket that was specifically fit for the homeless person's needs.
Right. Yep.
So we're working with them, and that item's actually still in development, but for example, it's got a harder wearing outer shell, it's got synthetic insulation that doesn't lose its insulating properties when it gets wet, it's slightly longer than our Nest jacket, so that it goes slightly lower. It doesn't pack down as small, it's not as lightweight, but it's harder wearing, and
yes.
it will last for years and keep people warm, which is what counts.
Absolutely, that hard wearing element, and the fact that, as you say, a technical down jacket, which is suitable for people going to the outdoors and coming back to a nice warm shelter,
yes,
is no good for someone without permanent shelter, because, as you say, down if it gets wet, it won't be warm at all. So there's a lot of thought gone into this, and you've worked with some partner agencies, partner charities as well. You're working with partner charities to develop these jackets that you are donating then. So how have you identified them? How did you find them?
Yeah, a lot of it, we've worked with we've been working with one locally, Cathedral Arch Project.
Yes.
Conversations with them. We've actually had conversations with actual homeless people on the streets.
Yes.
And talked to them about what their needs are.
Yes.
For a product like this. We also are working very closely with a large non-profit out in the US called One Warm Coat. They operate a model where they help people run what are called coat drives. So it would be somebody stood outside a supermarket, for example, asking people to donate their lightly used coats, and then they collect those, bundle them up, and then One Warm Coat help get those distributed to local partner shelters. And they've got about 500 different shelters they work with around the US. And it's worth noting that as well, that the homelessness situation in the US is significantly worse than it is here. I believe around 500,000 people are classed as being homeless, and in the US, and of those, about 150,000 people actually sleep rough on the streets in the country every single night, which, yeah, it's absolutely horrific. It's a huge, huge problem, and there's much. I've actually lived out in the US, and there's much. Is a significantly less safety net than there is here.
Yes.
To catch people if their lives take a turn in the wrong direction, we saw the issue, and these charities that we're working with are incredibly receptive to the idea that somebody would actually come and design a jacket that's really fit for the needs of the people they serve.
Yes, indeed. So a lot of thought has gone into this, and as you say, fit for the needs of the people that the jacket will serve. And you talked when you came on the show recently that you want to work in a way that if someone in the US is buying a Nesh jacket, then the Nesh, then the jacket that you donate that will go to someone who is homeless in the US. And if someone in the UK is buying a Nesh jacket, then the jacket designed for a homeless person in the UK will go to someone in the UK.
So that's absolutely right. Yeah, the intent is initially just as you outlined there. As we grow as a company, if the idea continues to resonate and people become receptive to our brand, it would make sense that we expand, or rather contract, that message, that pledge, such that you actually could do it on an almost micro level, so that if a person in Sheffield bought a jacket, that you would donate a jacket to somebody through a shelter rather within Sheffield, and you kind of could do it on a geographically much smaller area, so people know that they're actually helping somebody in their local area. As we are right now, as a very small startup, we can't really afford to be shipping single jackets to random towns and cities around the world.
Yes,
but
yeah,
you could imagine as we kind of grew and as our distribution base grew, that we actually might be able to do that. That would be our desire.
Yes, great stuff.
Yeah.
And you said that it's important to you as a business to be socially responsible, and that is something that quite a lot of folk talk about on this program. And this is a program about business and social enterprise, but I often say that we don't necessarily operate in silos. There are plenty of values-driven businesses, plenty of socially responsible, ordinary, traditional businesses. There are plenty of charities who are being forced to define themselves as social enterprises when they can't actually necessarily earn income. And social responsibility within business, clearly important to you. You also talked about the chain of custody when it comes to, say, the down that you use within the jacket, which I know has been a big issue in, say, the outdoor industry as well.
Yeah.
So I suppose What do you think of Sheffield as a place for social responsible business? Does it feel like that's something that is big here to you? You've worked all over the world, and I want to ask you about working in America. You talked about there being significantly less safety nets there for people. Does it feel, and this is just a sort of anecdotal evidence type question really, does it feel that Sheffield is a place where businesses are more socially responsible than other parts of the world?
I'm not so sure if I could kind of definitely hit the nail on the head and go, yes, that's definitely why we did it. We're from Sheffield, and it's just in our core. I know of businesses in the city that actually are operate on a very socially responsible level. I don't say that every business that is out there kind of has that drive, but there's definitely, I think, is the people of Sheffield they definitely care a lot more than some of the places that that I've lived in. You might notice from my accent, I'm not from around here. I actually came to Sheffield when I went to university, studied at Sheffield Hallam University, and stayed and started my business after that. But I'm actually from the south coast, just outside of London, and I don't feel people really care so much down there. I can't talk about everybody, but there's a lot of Tories down there, if I don't want to use the term too much, but people, basically, I think there's a lot of people who I feel that it's your job to make the best of your life, and it's your fault if you screw up. And I don't really feel you're always a product of the environment that you're in, the things that you have access to. There's a level of good fortune that you're afforded. I think some people forget that, and I think in Sheffield people are, in general, they care a lot more about their neighbour, and I think maybe that comes into it.
Yes. Yeah, indeed. So the city is famous for that care, I think. And lots of folk have talked on the programme about the difference in attitude, perhaps between the north and the south. Let's not sort of be totally stereotypical, because there are caring people in the south. But in general terms, you came here to go to university. You studied at Sheffield Hallam. What did you study?
I studied industrial design, and then continued on, did my master's in industrial design as well.
And you're a climber, which you mentioned earlier.
Yep.
Did that play a part in the influence of coming to Sheffield as well?
It did, yeah. It was one of the main reasons I chose to come here. It's one of the epicentres of UK climbing.
Yes.
And I was very much enthused by the access to the great outdoors that you're afforded in Sheffield. Yeah,
indeed. And a short bus ride, easy hitchhike, train ride, walk.
Yes. We've done all of those.
Bike ride out to Stanage, Burbage, etc., etc. So wonderful. So when did you study here then, Alan? When was that?
I'm trying to think now. I believe it was 2000. I was definitely studying in 2001, but I can't remember if that's when I started or finished my degree. I think I may have started in 2001. Okay, yeah, it feels like a long time ago now.
Right, great stuff. And you talked about you studied industrial product design here.
Yeah.
Sheffield Hallam, great place to do that as well, quite apart from the access to wonderful rock climbing. great place. Tell us more then about your career, because you talked about spending some time working in the States after university.
Yeah.
What's your career path?
It's been a little bit random. I suppose I always knew from relatively early on that I wouldn't ever work for anybody. I possibly have a slight problem with authority. I noticed that at university. I used to disagree with my tutors quite a lot.
Right.
They'll back me up on that. I realised that very early on. I was very quite forthright with my ideas, and becoming a junior designer in a large organisation and actually taking orders from somebody really wasn't on the cards for me. And I happened to find a compadre in Will Parsons, who's my business partner, and we both kind of felt that we really weren't of the employable sorts. We were, after our degrees, sitting in the pub, believe watching Champions League final, and we turned to each other. We might have had a beer or two, and I think one of us said, "You know, do you fancy starting a business together?"
Yeah.
One thing turned to another. We started a product design consultancy, and the whole aim of that consultancy was that we were going to develop our own ideas and pay for the development of them through doing consultancy for other people. So we charge a day rate, you know, get some money from day rate consultancy, and then we funnel that money into developing our own product ideas, which worked quite relatively well. The first idea that we were really keen on was a design that Will had come up with just outside of, I think he just finished his degree and was kind of playing a lot of summer football and realised that there really wasn't a good solution for portable football goals that are, you know, quick and easy to take to a park that you can put up in a few minutes and play with. All this stuff that was on the market was basically very big, very heavy, bulky, and took 10 to 15 minutes to put up if you had the instructions, and if not, then you're just messing around with a bundle of PVC plumbing pipes trying to figure out how it goes together. And he had this great idea based on tent technology, like dome tents where all the poles are connected together with elastic. And he was about 50 to 75% of the way there, but couldn't get it the final bit. And we started working on this idea together. And between the two of us, we managed to get what we thought was actually a really cool football goal. And so we'd made a few contacts within manufacturing in China. A couple of our clients had sent us out to China. And so we thought, oh, why don't we just make this ourselves? And so one thing led to another. We went out to China, sourced the manufacturer, designed all the parts, opened the tooling for the plastic parts. We ordered our first production run. We had it delivered to a container arrived at this tiny office that we were occupying. We handballed it all into the back corner of the office.
Right.
And then we realized that it was all completely broken because one particular part wouldn't actually, it would break every time somebody someone set it up. And so we ended up spending, we reworked all of those parts completely manually. And fast forward a little bit, basically, I mean, we stumbled and we kind of took steps forward, and we launched on Amazon, and we started getting retailers, and we kind of grew, and eventually the product kind of, we sorted all the product quality issues out, and it started selling really well.
Yes.
By this time, we'd actually already spun it off into its own company, which is called Quick Play Sport.
Yeah.
And that company still exists today, and it's, that's still one of our focuses. And we, at that time, we were, I believe, the number one selling football goal on Amazon.co.uk during the World Cup, which would have been I can't remember which World Cup it was. There's been a few since then.
There's been a few, yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, right during the middle of the World Cup, we were outselling the official World Cup football on Amazon.
Right. Okay.
And we were like, wow, this is actually going somewhere. And at that point, we were trying to enter the US market, and we were looking for either retailers or distributors. Couldn't figure out how to really kind of deal with that market, given the space and the time zone differences, those sorts of things. And a company contacted us who said, love what you're doing, we're in a similar area in sports training equipment, we'd like to license your product. Not done licensing before, so we picked up the phone to one of the Sheffield Hallam Enterprise Centre, and we said, this company wants to do a license deal with us, and we got some advice through them, which was great. One thing led to another, we basically licensed the technology to them, and they turned around to us and actually went, love what you guys are doing, you're brilliant designers, do you fancy coming over here and heading up our design team?
Right.
And Will, Sheffield born and bred, he said, no, I'm staying here. I love my city. And I absolutely love Sheffield, but when somebody turns around to you and says, do you want to move to California?
Yeah.
It's very hard to not look twice.
Not to be missed.
So one thing led to another, and I was like, I took a short sabbatical from my work at Quick Play, popped over to the US, spent a few years working for this company.
Yeah.
in that time, developed, you know, a bunch of different bits of sports equipment. It was very interesting because actually they're a much bigger company than us, and I kind of used that almost as a way to learn how a bigger company operates.
Yeah.
And the growing pains that they were going through. When I left them, I was able to kind of come back to Quick Play and go, well, these guys went through these issues, and so let's try and not make those same mistakes. So
yeah.
I lived over in California for a few years, and then parted ways with that company. By that time, Quick Play felt that it was big enough to set up its own US entity. So my wife and I set up that US entity. We operated it out of spare bedroom in our house.
Yeah, okay.
But we basically imported all the stock into Amazon's warehouses, so we didn't have to hide it in the garage or anything like that. But
yeah.
Very quickly turned that from a standing start to $500,000 in its first year, $1.5 million in its second year, and now it's a massive market over there. It's absolutely huge.
Yes.
And after a while, we thought, okay, that's all nice, running nicely, and we missed home, so we can kind of pop back over to China. We've been back here for about a year, and in that time, we were kind of playing around with this idea of developing this new jacket, and having built up all these manufacturing contacts in China over a 10 to 15 year period, we thought, oh, this is something that we can do. And so that's kind of how we got to where we are now with the new project.
What an absolutely fascinating story, and what an amazing journey. so many questions I want to ask you about this then, Alan. I suppose, first of all, tips and advice for anyone who is manufacturing and sourcing a manufacturer in China, because it's something that a lot of people have talked about either doing or wanting to do. What do you know now that perhaps would have been helpful to know right at the start of that journey when it comes to finding partners and working with manufacturers?
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually, and it's so much easier now than it was when we started. Alibaba, the big platform for Chinese suppliers, it was just in its infancy back then, and it was a bit of a cowboy Wild West scenario. You didn't really know who you were getting. So we actually ended up, I mentioned about all of that stock breaking when we first imported it. We ended up sacking that particular manufacturer, and funnily enough, as we ended up licensing the technology to the US company, we put a little clause in there that said, we can buy from your manufacturer. So we ended up getting a really good introduction to what happened to be a sourcing agent. And the sourcing agent model used to be really, really big in China. Basically, it was typically Taiwanese sourcing agents who had a team of people who'd speak really good English and also really good Chinese, and they'd have factory contracts in China. And so they were this kind of middle link, this bridge between Western, European and American companies who wanted to get into China, and between these Chinese factories who had absolutely no English, no understanding in how to deal with English-speaking companies. And so we worked with them for many years, and for good and for bad, there's pluses and minuses to that model. You don't get a lot of price transparency, for example. They just give you a price, but they say that they're putting a markup on it of a few percentage points, but you look around and you think, hang on a sec, it might be closer to 20%. And they also, they can be your quality agent. So there's different ways that's beneficial. But realistically, these days, talking about advice, actually, Alibaba these days is one of the best ways that you can actually get in touch with a new manufacturer. Their systems kind of really well fleshed out. They've got, for example, you can see a supplier how long they've been on the platform for, so it'll say that they've been a gold supplier for 9 years or something. You can see how many transactions that have operated through them, so there's a lot of data in their system, right, that kind of gives you a bit of trust that they're not just someone who's just set up shop and is masquerading as a factory.
I see. So significantly more data transparency.
Exactly. You can kind of see like all these different things, and they've on all these factories have just cottoned onto the fact that all the money is in European and the American businesses, so they're all hiring English-speaking sales staff now. So yes. Actually operating a factory direct relationship is actually not tremendously difficult.
Right.
You do have to deal with things like, you know, their payment terms, which are often 30% up front when you place your order and 70% when you ship the goods. So yes. You're a little bit out of pocket there. You've got to fund that. Often with the sourcing agent model, they can be a bit of a bridge funding gap as well, depending mm-hmm. on how much they believe in your product and how your relationship is with them. So there's pluses and minuses to both. But my advice to people would be, start with Alibaba. It is really that easy. Just kind of do your due diligence. Look at the things that are key. If they've been around for quite a while, if they have quite a high level of transactions that go through their account, you know, their turnover is quite high, that sort of thing.
Right.
Do they speak English? Do they reply to your emails quickly? Do
yes.
they, you know, when you ask certain questions, do they give you what feel like transparent answers?
Okay, really sage advice there. Really helpful advice there, I think, as well. And just briefly to touch on that, you talked about sourcing agents in the past having been quality assurance or quality agents as well. Did that sometimes lead to conflicts of interest, and is it wise for people to appoint a quality auditor or quality assurance manager of some description?
Yeah, one of the worst things you can do is let your sourcing agent do your quality checking
yeah.
for you.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there is a big conflict of interest there, because they are serving their own interests. They're serving the interests of the factory. Although they're supposed to be your client, their relationships often are all with a long term relationships that they're funneling new clients to. So they are defending the factory. They're also trying to defend their own margin. Factories have got a habit in China of what is deemed quality fade. Mm. So you'll end up with a product you sampled, and maybe your first couple of production runs will be great.
Yes.
Over time, they'll start looking for where they can find margin, and that often means just degrade the quality of a particular item, a particular material within your product slightly, and hope that the client doesn't notice.
Yes.
And if that means that your product breaks, that's when you notice and that you have issues. And so it is really useful to actually have a third party who does that independent quality checking for
right,
you.
Yes.
And those aren't tremendously difficult to find either. There's quite a lot of resource on the internet to basically find people, and they'll you give them a remit, whatever your requirements are. Go to the factory, inspect X number of goods, check them for this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
Write me a report, and then you do that before the product ships, so that you can pick up on anything that might be an issue before you ship it to yourself. Because it's a lot more difficult to sort it out at this end when
yes.
it's sitting here in your warehouse than it is to tell a factory that you've got to rework it all.
You're right, and as you found when a part was broken back with the football product in the 2000s.
Yeah. That was the first big mistake you make, and you continue to make them, unfortunately. you always end up with if manufacturing, it seems to, and selling, especially in the markets that we're in, they're seasonally driven. You have a demand to get your product here for the right time. Like World Cup's coming up, I need to have football goals at this particular time.
Yes.
You start cutting corners and cross your fingers, hope for the best. It's not you don't do that all over the place, but you always there's always a bit of give and take, really, because there's always going to be tight time scales, that sort of thing. So
yeah,
some things you can be really confident about that it's going to be fine, and some things you have to be a bit more diligent on.
Right. Yeah, I think that's been very helpful indeed. Very helpful advice in terms of sourcing and manufacturer quality and checking and the lessons that you've learned during over 10 years of doing this.
So
great, thank you for that. Okay, another big question then is about crowdfunding. You have a wonderful product which has clearly resonated with people for two very, very big reasons. One, it's a great product that people who enjoy the outdoors can see is a great product in terms of the thought that's gone into the design. Secondly, the socially responsible element and the idea that by buying this product, you support shelter, you support warmth, rather, for homeless people who don't have permanent shelter. You are enabling a jacket, a coat to be given to a homeless person.
Yep.
And so this has really absolutely resonated with people. But to have achieved the success you have within, say, 12 days of starting a Kickstarter campaign, a crowdfunding campaign, to smash through a target, and it wasn't a tiny target to make it super easy to smash through. It was a £15,000 target. You're up to £52,000 in orders. Any advice then? What has made your crowdfunding campaign so successful? How did you approach planning this crowdfunding campaign? I know how much planning goes into a successful campaign. What tips do you have for other folk?
Yeah, you're absolutely right there. It does start with planning, and I think I had delusions earlier on in the year that around March time I was like, right, we'll get the crowdfunding campaign up for May. That's the aim. As things went on, we suddenly realised, we're like, oh gosh, we're not getting it done for May. Well, maybe July. We're like, we can't sell down jackets in July. That's a stupid idea. Well, maybe we'll get it ready for September, and September rolled straight through, and we thought, okay, 1st of October. Anyway, it basically comes down to preparation. There's just so much that goes on, and everybody's always got something else going on, unless you can't really devote 100% of your time to it, because you've got, you know, a day job, you've got a business that we're running, you've got other things that are pulling on your life. So yeah, take as much time as you can. The main things for a crowdfunding campaign are really getting an amazing video done. I think it's one of the most crucial things to get, convincing people that your message and your product is worth investing in. And that just takes time. There's a formula to doing it, but especially with a down jacket, fortunately, it was absolutely lovely, but we'd go out to the Peak District 20, 30 times to film various things, which is fantastically enjoyable, but takes forever. I'm sure that some products which are really easy, because you probably do the entire video in your living room, but we didn't have that luxury to make it look authentic.
No.
We had to go out to one of the most beautiful places in the country, so that just took quite a while, and you've got weather windows, those sorts of things, and arranging whoever's going to be modeling the stuff. There's bits of me in it, bits of my business partner in it, my wife's in it, some of the people from the office have been in it too. So yeah, you've got to kind of pull that all together, I think. And because it was our first time actually creating that video, figuring out what the message was one of the more tricky things, because you put together a draft of the video, you'd look at it and you'd go, no, it doesn't really get the message across, and maybe if we filmed something slightly different, and you change the voice over here and there. It took quite a while, and I think just be honest, if your first time, it's probably just going to take you ages to do absolutely everything.
Yes, indeed.
We looked at basically running the crowdfunding campaign ourselves. And there are agencies who consult and basically help you through the process, and also kind of market your campaign as it's running, in the build up to the campaign, and then as it's running as well. And we, because it was our first campaign, thought to make it the biggest splash possible, let's get one of these agencies on board. So we interviewed a bunch of them, and the way that most of them operate is essentially on a revenue share model. So you'll pay a small upfront fee, and they will then advise you on various aspects of your campaign, and then they will also do things like they'll run Facebook advertising, drive people towards a landing page, collect their email address, and people maybe are entering an award, a giveaway to win a jacket. Yeah. That's what we did. So you collect a few thousand email addresses in this build up, and then they do a combination of email marketing campaigns and Facebook advertising throughout the campaign to drive people towards the campaign page to get them to back the project. So we went down this model, and as I mentioned, they operate on a revenue share, so they take a percentage of your revenue that you. Mm-hmm. It's not a massive percent, but you've got to make sure you factor that in to your profit and loss calculations as you build that out.
Yes.
The other thing too is what we've learned is that Kickstarter backers are they love a deal. That's the best way to put it.
Right.
They love to think they're getting the best possible deal, and so you are very much driven to push your price as low as possible,
right,
to get right as close as possible to you know, where you're not making much profit, or you're making a loss maybe on some of the very early bird offers to try and get people to cross the line and back the project. So that's something you should probably be prepared for, in that you'll have an end retail price that you will want to sell at on, say, your website, or you know, if you go down the retailer route, that sort of thing. But at the end of the day, people on Kickstarter, that it's a massive community, but they love to back projects where they know they're getting a fantastic deal.
Yeah,
and that's something we found, really. I think one of the reasons that we funded in, I think, 24 hours, we kind of,
yes,
we were about 30 minutes before the 24 hour mark that we hit our 15 grand yeah. goal, was because those early birds were priced such that they were just such a fantastic yeah. deal.
And the early birds were a limited number
yeah.
of incredibly good deals,
yeah.
And people can see the comparison with the next set of jackets that were going to be available at a higher price after the really limited ones,
yeah.
So it made them act fast.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. yeah. And also, you kind of, within your campaign page, you try and present the story of kind of the quality of the product. We did a comparison, for example, with some leading brands, and we
yes.
said, like, this is what you're getting with our product, with their product, and this is what you pay at the end. You try and convince people that it's, you know, you're really getting an amazing deal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And are you prepared to name the agency who you chose and worked with, or?
I'm not, no, because there's quite a few of them out there. Mm. And
so tips on choosing them then?
I think really, because it all comes down to the separate project. Some agencies are better at certain Kickstarter campaigns
yes,
than others, because Kickstarter
enough, yeah.
is such a broad platform that some people are doing film projects, book projects, you've got product projects, and anything in between. There's a lot you can fund on Kickstarter, and some of those we interviewed quite a lot of them, and some of them they specialized in certain areas that are more than others. So I wouldn't necessarily recommend to go towards any one particular agency. It really depends on your particular project.
Well, that's absolutely fair.
And you just, yeah, you just do your due diligence, like with them. You ask them about, have they backed projects that are like yours in the past? You know,
yes.
What's your evidence of, like, how many of these sorts of projects have you had success with, and what have you done to make those a success? Those sorts of things, and just whether or not that team feels like a good fit, because you're going to work with them very closely. At the end of the day, they're you know, you emailing them every single day. You're on weekly phone calls with them, and yeah, you've just got to be comfortable, because they become an extension of your team for a short while.
Yeah, too right. Absolutely. Well, yeah. That's good advice. That's been really, really helpful, I think. Fantastic.
Thanks.
So the campaign still has 18 days to run, I believe, and you can still go to kickstarter.com, look up the Nesh jacket, find details of the jacket, and you're able to still get as of today anyway, looking at the Kickstarter page, you can still get a Nesh jacket before Christmas at a... still with a fantastic reduction from the RRP. So
yeah,
take
a look. We've just launched our Black Friday sale. So we decided that we were going to run a Black Friday sale that's going to probably run through till Cyber Monday, depending on how quickly we sell through the units we've allotted for that. And you can get, like, an absolutely fantastic deal on it. So yeah, it's a great time to take advantage of that.
Wonderful. Well, brilliant. Alan, we could go on. I'd love to carry on speaking. Time really does fly when you're having fun. It's 5 to 10. We've got about a minute of the show left. So if folk want to find out more, they can take a look at the Kickstarter page. And as you say, fantastic sale over the weekend as well. Find out more about you. Find out more about the jacket. Watch the amazing video, which is superb. You're speaking also at Pecha Kucha next week, I believe.
I am, yes. Yeah, looking forward to that.
Brilliant. So tickets still available for Pecha Kucha. So if you take a look at Pecha Kucha Sheffield, PKN Chef on Twitter. You don't have to have a Twitter account. Just look them up on Twitter and you'll be able to then find the link through to... the details for the next Pecha Kucha, which is next week at the Mowbray. Alan will be speaking, amongst others. This has been really interesting. I've found it really fascinating speaking with you. Thank you ever so much
for coming. Yeah, thanks for having me.
And best of luck with this amazing project and,
thank
and
you.
Product and everything else you're doing. Do you still have time to go climbing?
I'm actually planning to go to the gym, climbing gym this morning. I frequent the climbing works. It's one of my second homes. But yeah, I try and make time. It's one of the advantages of being just 10-minute drive from, you know, some of the best bouldering and climbing in the world is quite useful. So
absolutely. Yeah. Great stuff. Well, Alan Holland, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks
on
very
the
much,
program
Jamie.
Today.
Cheers.
And you've been listening to Business Live, our weekly business and social enterprise program with me, Jamie Veitch. Alan Holland's been on the show today. We've been talking about the Nest Jacket. That's been fascinating, fabulous, and thank you so much for Alan for coming in today and talking with us. Thank you for listening. Thanks also Sangeeta in the studio as our sound engineer. Don't go away now, because next up on Sheffield Live is the fantastic folk music programme. Thank goodness it's folk, from 10 all the way through to noon. So enjoy that. We'll play out with a little bit of Foals. This is Mountain at My Gates.
This is Sheffield Live.
We're open for business live.